T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Day, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Jaworski gives off inside, running room, Montgomery up the right side, left 30, 25, 40, 15, 10, touchdown! Herbert Montgomery! Montgomery explodes on the right side, and the Eagles have scored first.
Well, you just heard one of the great plays in Eagles history, Wilbert Montgomery, in the 1980 NFC Championship game. What Merrill Reese didn't say there is that the key block was thrown by left tackle Stan Walters on Cowboys defensive end Harvey Martin. Stan anchored the Eagles line for 9 seasons, 2-time Pro Bowler, member of the team's Hall of Fame, and then after that, of course, spent 14 seasons as the team's excitable color commentator alongside Merrill Reese. Stan joins us now for Tell Us Your Story. Stan, it is a pleasure to connect with you again.
Glenn, Ray, thank you very much. I'm honored. I'm honored to be on this show. You know, as an offensive lineman, we don't get many for publicity, so I appreciate it.
Well, let's start at the beginning as we do. You grew up in Rutherford, New Jersey. Eagles fans have been through there when they go to Giants games. You were a Giants fan. Give us your first memory of football as a kid.
My first memory of football as a kid was playing in sixth grade for Mr. Cavallano in the Bulldogs team of the town league. And Mr. Cavallano let everybody play whatever position. It was good. I got to say, I was very fortunate. Whatever level I played on, the coaches coached on their level. My junior football coach didn't think he was Vince Lombardi. My high school coach didn't think he was Don Shula or Tom Landry. So I was every level I played on, I had coaches, and I appreciate to this fact, when I went to Syracuse with Ben Schwartzwelder, he said, hey, come here, play football the first season, and then second season, off season, go out and enjoy the college life. He goes, we kind of steal from you with that. You don't get 4 years of a college education to go out and experience the world.
I know that you, your dad was a machinist, and you lived in that area right up around East Rutherford. In fact, you said from the second floor window in that house, you could actually see Giant Stadium. That's how close you were. But I remember you talking a lot about your dad being just this hardworking guy, was a machinist. Worked his time, got overtime on Saturdays, and you always said that you felt like those are the guys that really have it tough in life. Everybody gives glory to the athletes and the people they see on television, but the real backbone of all of our society are the guys like your dad that just go to work every day. And you always regarded him, even though your dad wasn't a football player, you regarded him as a terrific role model.
Well, my dad was. And, you know, going to work every day, and then people say, oh, you play pro football. I go, pro football's easy. Pro football's a gift. Pro football is, I never considered it a job that way. To me, grinding out 40 hours a week and then trying to get an extra 8 hours in on Saturday, that was the hard part. I'm living an easy life. So I always look back. And my father was a union president. And one thing he taught me, he goes, don't worry about the people above you on the economic ladder. Worry about the people below you. He goes, don't try to be as rich as the next guy. He goes, worry about the other. And he taught that. My parents taught me that. And that's why I've had a liberal view in life, through college and through the rest of my life.
Very nice. So, as you mentioned, you went to Syracuse University playing under Ben Schwartzwelder, a very successful coach. I see that you were selected to the University's All-Century team in 1999, so you must have had a very successful college career, but I also see that you were drafted in the 9th round in 1972. Were you disappointed by that?
No, not at all. First of all, let me just say, I did not play football because I loved the game. Basketball was the game I loved. But somewhere in high school, when we had an undefeated basketball season, I realized I was too slow to play guard, too small to play forward. I think Bill Rafferty, who knew a nun in our school, came down and scouted me, and I think he told her that, right? And so football was always something I went along because I was drafted by my size. Syracuse took me for my size. I was a ninth-round draft choice because of my size. There's a little more to that story. But it was always something I just did because it opened up the next opportunity. I was not one of these guys that loved football, loved crashing into people, all that. I was doing it because it opened up the next opportunity. And that was it when I went to Syracuse. Now, at Syracuse, I wasn't a very good football player because we were using an unbalanced line, which Walter ran the ball 95% of the time, and I was not a killer. But that actually helped me because I got drafted by the pros, and what they accused me of chicken fighting in Syracuse football because I wasn't firing off the ball actually made me an offensive tackle in the National Football League because that's what pass blocking is.
Well, I remember you telling me years ago, and I don't know if you were kidding or not, but you said that when the Cincinnati Bengals sent you the plane ticket to go come in after they drafted you to come in and do and come to training camp, they sent you a round trip ticket, which wasn't exactly a ringing vote of endorsement.
Was that they did? I guess Paul Brown did that. I forgot about that. He just brought it up. Yes, it was a round trip ticket from Newark Airport to Cincinnati, and the thing about it, Ray, about Paul Brown. Was I had been in Cincinnati about 6 weeks, and the day, week after the draft, they drafted me because they took Sherman White, a defensive end, number one, and they wanted somebody to work out with him. They couldn't ask the veterans to come out and work out with him, so they would fly Sherman and I in 1 week a month, right, to work out. We stayed at a hotel. I mean, it was great. I go, oh, this is pro football. Look at they give me like $30 a day to catch the cab. I signed for my meals in the Netherlands hotel. I go, this is great. But what they were doing was they needed an offensive tackle to work against Sherman. Well, so I had 4 weeks and then 2 weeks before training camp to do that. I went in there much more than a rookie. You know what I mean? I had learning, and I also met Tiger Johnson and learned Tiger Johnson's offensive line play. And I got to study the playbook. So that's the reason I believe I made the pro football team is because of that extra learning before going into pro camp.
That's interesting. So in your rookie season, you get your chance to start because Rufus Mays, who was the starter at tackle, gets injured. What was it like just kind of rookie season playing against, you know, established NFL vets and stars? How was your debut?
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm sitting there and Rufus gets hurt and they go, we're going to start you. Okay. So that week I'm working with the starters, right? And then there was an incident in practice where Tiger Johnson had me going against the defensive end. And then he says, okay, get another defensive end in there. They brought another defensive end. Then I went through every defensive lineman, and I pass blocked them all. The last guy I was going against was Mike Reed, the All-Pro from Penn State.
Sure.
Great play, right? And all of a sudden, I jumped out at him, and I missed him. And Tiger Johnson gets in my face. What'd you do? What'd you do? I said, well, I thought he was thinking. He goes, don't do that. He goes, they react. He goes, you blocked everybody on this team. Don't change up for anybody. You can block. You're a pass blocker. You can block. And then he said, the second thing is, he said, don't ever give the credit to the defense for thinking. If they could think, they would be on offense. That's the line I used all the time against my former defensive players. If defensive players could think, they'd play offense. So then I started that game. My first game is against Elvin Bethea of the Houston Oilers. Now, Elvin Bethea goes on to a Hall of Fame career, but back then he was just starting to make the Pro Bowls. And I had an excellent game. I didn't get to give up a sack. And then after the game, I never forget, Bill Walsh was one of the first people to my locker room. The great San Francisco coach was an assistant. And he shook my hand. He said, good job. Then Tiger Woods said, not Tiger Johnson. Tiger Johnson said, good job. But Friday before that game, I'm nervous about starting. Paul Brown calls me into his office. It's the first time he calls me in. He said, listen, he said, if I didn't think you could play, you wouldn't be starting. Go out there and play your game. Don't be nervous. You can play in this league. And, I mean, that gives you all the confidence in the world to go out and play. And then that year I played, and I didn't give up a sack my rookie year, the last eight games of the season.
Well, that's pretty good. Well, you had one of the things that's true throughout your career, really, is that you had the good fortune of playing for great coaches. I mean, Ben Schwartzwalder is a legend in college football. Then you get drafted, you get an opportunity to go play for Paul Brown, and then later on you get to play for Dick Vermeil. All these guys are Hall of Famers. But, you know, Paul Brown was already a legend by the time you got to him. I mean, he had already established his reputation with coaching the Cleveland Browns and came back with the Cincinnati Bengals, and they're all different versions of what kind of a guy Paul Brown was to play for. How was it for you?
Well, I'll tell you, my loyalty to him really sets me up for years later. But my rookie year, I go through the season, and last 8 games I start. I hold the position all during training camp. And this is what I was going to tell you. Right? This is the secret I'm telling you for the first time in 40 years. The Friday before the first game, my second year, it's the second time Paul Brown calls me into his office. He calls me into his office and he says, "Stan, you held the job. You're playing as well as Sherman White and better than Tommy Casanova and Sherman White, our first and second rounds when you were drafted." He said, "I'm raising your contract." I went from making $18,000 a year. He gave me a contract to $30,000 a year that second year. And that was the secret that I kept. He said, "But don't tell anybody." And I never did until just now. That the thing about Paul Brown being a cheap player and the Cincinnati Bengals cheap, I just say that's not true. That's not true. He was from the old school. He wanted to pay after you performed.
I imagine you thought you had all the money in the world at the time. And then, after several years with the Bengals, in July 1975, you get traded to the Eagles. Mostly, people may remember John Reeves, the quarterback, and his second-round pick the Eagles got in return. What did you know or what did you think about this city and the franchise coming in?
Okay, I grew up in Rutherford, New Jersey. I was a Giants fan. Charlie Connolly, Y.A. Tittle, Frank Gifford, the whole thing. I was a Giants fan the way you guys were Eagle fans. Right. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, and I used to say, you know, man, Philadelphia, I hated them. I hated the Eagles. Right. When I got traded, I actually said in the offseason, because of my first 3 years in the Bengals, we made the playoffs 2 out of 3 years. And I actually remember saying to somebody, man, I couldn't imagine playing for a team like the Eagles where you're out of the playoffs by the 7th game of the season. I go, it's great making that money, but being in the playoff race is really exciting. And all of a sudden, I wake up 2 weeks after I got married. And I was ready to go to Cincinnati. He traded me for John Reese and a second-round draft choice along with Wayne Clark. And I remember when Tiger Johnson called me up after Mike McCormick told me, he said, "Remember," he said, "you realize what you did? You went from a ninth rounder. We're trading you for a number one draft quarterback and a second-round draft pick." And I said, "Well, Wayne Clark." He goes, "No, we're throwing him so we don't have to cut him." He said, "Do you realize what you're worth now? And I remember Tiger Johnson saying, "You realize what you're worth?" And then I went to the Philadelphia Eagles, and I tell you, that was a year of depression. 1975 was a year of depression, and years later, when I ran into Mike McCormick when he was with the Carolina Panthers, I told him, I said, "Mike, I don't know what happened that year, but that was I just was not a good player. I was not a good man," and he wound up getting fired that year, and I always felt guilty about that.
Yeah, that was a brutal year. 75 was really, that was really a bad year. And it was the end of Mike McCormick, but it was just the beginning for you in Philadelphia. In 1976, they hire this youthful 39-year-old coach from UCLA named Dick Vermeil comes in and runs a training camp the likes of which I had never seen anything like it before. I've been around football a long time. I've never seen a training camp as tough as the one that Dick put you guys through out at Widener in 76. What was your first impressions of Vermeil? Because I know he was very tough on the veterans, and he was tough on you.
Okay, the first thing was, first of all, let me just give you some background. Paul Brown ran what I call professional training camp. We practiced an hour and a half in the morning and an hour and a half in the afternoon. That was it. You were done. Our meetings were, you went to meeting at 10 o'clock in the morning, you got out by 11, you went for lunch, came back at 1:30, you were off the field by 3. I'm going, wow, this is pro football. I'm making $30,000 a year back in the 70s. This is pro football. All of a sudden, I wake up one morning, and here comes this guy from California who's almost the same age as I am. Maybe he looked younger than I did. And all of a sudden, I'm going through training camps. It was a brutal, brutal awakening. It was very I can't even remember. All I remember is the pain of that first training camp. It was brutal. But I do remember one time, this was interesting, Dick Vermeil said, "Anybody who doesn't want to be on the Eagles, come see me. If you can't handle this, if you want to see this, come see me." I went in to see him. I said, "Coach, if you're looking to trade somebody, I'll trade somebody." He goes, "What do you mean?" I go, "Well, we talked about it. I told him that I was used to pro football. This is crazy." And that's when he told me, "Hey, I'm looking for the last 5 guys to make this team." And I said, well, you're killing 40 to make five. You know what I mean? That was tough. That was tough. And then later on, he gave me the brutal awakening of what I was in pro football for, was there was a wives' night. And he went over and talked to my wife, Kathy, and he said, Stan's seems to be unhappy. And she said, yes. He goes, he's unhappy. He goes, and she goes, we got to keep him here. He goes, he's not going anywhere. Now, she never told me that to years later, that he said, he's not going anywhere. And I had to learn. He forced me to buy into his program. I never quite bought into it, but he forced me to work in his program.
Well, you bought into it enough, or you worked it enough, that you became an outstanding player here. You on the left side, Jerry Sizemore on the east side, the right side, excuse me, for years. It was a hell of a line that you guys anchored. I guess I'd ask you at this point just kind of about Jerry Sizemore, because the Eagles have been lucky over their history. When they had a good left tackle, they tend to have a good right tackle. You guys were that pair. Tell us a little bit about your relationship with Jerry Sizemore.
Well, we roomed together. We roomed together, and I think Jerry and I had the basic – I was from the Northeast liberal. He's a Texas conservative. But the one thing we had in common, we were just playing football because it was a great job. Not that we loved the physicalness and the killness, like some players would say, let's kill him. You know, Jerry and I did our jobs. We did our jobs. We had that one thing in common. And the second thing, I think we both worried. Now, Jerry was drinking Maalox every night. Because he was getting an ulcer. I mean, Vermeil put a lot of tension on you. There was a lot of tension throughout training camp, throughout the season. There was always tension. Sizemore was drinking Maalox for his ulcer, and I'm smoking packs of cigarettes to relieve the nerves. And that's where we got along. Now, you talk about leadership on the team. Jerry was a quiet leader. To me, I would look across the huddle because we were lined up opposite each other. And in hot, humid days, I would look over and look in his eyes. And I go, if he can do it, I've got to do it. I've got to do it. He's my friend. I can't let him down. And that was my inspiration. In tight games, we'd be in a tight game. Last 2 minutes, I'm going, geez, I can't give up a sack. It's a two-minute drill. And you look across to him, and he would just kind of nod his head with that. I think you recognize it. You might recognize it, Ray Glenn, where he just shakes his head with that eye and say, it will be all right. You know what I mean? That was my leader on the Philadelphia Eagles. That was the guy I looked to say, hey, I got to hang in there. I got to be tough. Because there are many times, third and 18, two-minute drill, you're almost praying to God, I wish I was anywhere but here, because if you give up the sack, you're going to cost us. I mean, I played out of fear, you know, fear of screwing up.
Yeah, I remember that very well. And I it was very funny that you and Jerry were such good friends, and yet you were such opposites. As you point out, you're a, you know, liberal from the Northeast. He's a Texas conservative. The one thing you had in common is you both loved to fish. You had that in common. But, I mean, that where you guys dressed in the very, very, very back of that old vet stadium locker room. You guys were back sort of by the shower door, and they had all the all the offensive linemen were in that little corner back there.
Yeah.
And it was so funny because you were, as you mentioned, you were a chain smoker. I mean, you smoked all the time. And Size was right across from you, and he and Guy Morris shared the spittoon. I mean, it was really an interesting sociological experiment to go back there and see you guys. And I wonder, you know, did anybody ever get on you about the smoking part of it? Because I mean, you always had the ashtray full, and the drop ceiling over your locker was yellow by the end of the season with all the nicotine. I mean, I don't think you could do that in today's NFL.
I don't think anybody smokes in the NFL. That was just nerves. That was just nerves. I played football out of fear of failure. And then when Dick was coaching it, the tension of you couldn't make a mistake. I mean, you went through practice and he taped practice, and the next day you'd go in there, and if you made a mistake in practice, just that, now it's not a live drill, but if you didn't have your foot in the right position, you know, he coached and the coaches coached to, you got yelled at, or at least I felt I was getting yelled at. You know what I mean? And then Dick would give his pre-practice speech about we're going to work to get better. I mean, it was just tremendous tension. So between us back there, we felt the tension of the offensive line, because even though the quarterbacks and the running backs, you know, are the glamour positions, the pressure was on the offensive and defensive lines that we felt, and I felt that, you know, it was up to us and the pressure of Dick Vermeil to make the offensive line work, and especially in those early days when we were trying to establish a running game.
Well, it culminated. We got about 4 minutes before we need to take a break, and so let's get to where it peaks, which is the 1980 season, where the Eagles get to the championship game. We played the Wilbert run to start this thing. You pull a muscle early in that game, but you're not gonna leave that game. Is that correct?
Yes, I injured my back, the lowered back, right? And I was towards the end of the first half, and the injured back, and they took me in, and I was laying there, and the Eagles had a great trainer in Otho Davis and a great doctor in Dr. DeStefano. And I'm laying in the training room, and Otho saying how you feel and everything. He's putting ice on it and everything. And then Vince DeStefano comes over, and he examines it. And he goes, what do you think, Stan? I go, it's hurting, it's hurting. He goes, I just want to let you know, it has nothing to do with your spine. It's strictly muscles. And we could give you a muscle relaxer or a painkiller in your back. I forget exactly what it was. But he said, but I trusted those two that they said I could play and it wouldn't be a bad thing. You know, it wasn't the spine. So I said, okay, give me a shot. And they gave me a shot, and I was able to go out and play the second half. Although I had trouble getting up and down in my stance, and I think after the game, I was afraid that one time I would get down in my stance, I wouldn't get out because it was I felt I would lock up, and it would have to carry me off the field in a 3-point stance. You know what I mean? but at that time, I couldn't take myself out of the game. Yeah. I mean, there would have to be the doctor saying no, because the competitive spirit that we all had that day was to play, that we're going to play the Dallas Cowboys even up in our stadium for the championships and a chance to go to the Super Bowl. There's no way you pull yourself out of a game there.
All right, well, let's take a quick break and come back, and Ray, we'll focus on that game a little bit more, and then get into Stan Walters' great career as a broadcaster with the Eagles as well. Stan Walters is our guest on Tell Us Your Story, sponsored by Meridian Bank, one of the area's best business banks. Learn why at meridianbanker.com/WIP.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.
Eagles come winning it. They stop the Cowboys here. They give it to Smith. He doesn't make it. They stop them. The Eagles take over on downs. The Eagles take over on downs. The referees are talking. We've got the problem. We've got the problem.
They're going to call the two-minute warning. They're going to say it was no play. Eagles stop them once. Can they stop them again?
Welcome back. Along with Ray Dinger, I'm Glenn Mack now. It is time for the second half of Tell Us Your Story, sponsored by Meridian Bank, one of the area's best business banks. Learn why at meridianbanker.com/WIP. Our guest today is Stan Walters, and when we went to break, Stan was lined up against Harvey Martin in the 1980 championship game, right?
Yeah, with a back full of Novocaine. There is a lot to cover, but I'm not quite ready to let go of that game yet. And Stan, I remember your team. You flew down to Tampa. You spent the week before that game in Tampa because the weather in Philadelphia was so brutal. It was so cold that Dick didn't feel he could get quality work. So he took the whole team down to Tampa. So you were down in Tampa all week. You flew back into the city like on Saturday. And I remember you saying that from the time you got back into the city, The feeling, the emotion in the city that you guys could, it was palpable. I mean, you guys could feel it. I mean, you knew what this whole thing, the whole Dick Vermeil program had really been building for this moment for 5 years to get to a championship game and to play the Dallas Cowboys, which was the, I mean, that was your white whale. That was the team that you had been hunting for 5 years, and here it was. And I've often said that I've been around football a long time and been to a lot of stadiums. I don't think I ever felt a home field advantage that was greater than what you guys had at the Vet that day. I mean, the emotion in that building, I just didn't think there was any way, as good as the Cowboys were, and they were good, that they were going to be able to beat you that day in that stadium.
Ray, when we got off the plane flying back from Tampa, which the genius of Dick Vermeil, he took us down there. We got our work in without any excitement. We were just working a regular work week, getting ready. Dick was saying, we got to play the Cowboys. They're going to do this, that. Okay. When we got off the plane and we're walking to our cars, you could feel the electric excitement in the city. I mean, it's an amazing feeling that the guys are sitting there, go get them, go get them. And all of a sudden, we have that Saturday, that night, you're feeling the electricity. But we didn't over panic. We didn't feel it until the last minute. And that was a buildup to the game. And I remember, you know, we're getting ready. Dick goes, we waited a long time for this. This is it. When are we going to beat the Cowboys? Maybe it's tonight. Maybe it's today. And you just felt it. I mean, the determination. It wasn't rah-rah. It wasn't a lot of it. You could just see and feel the determination more than the excitement of playing that game of 45 guys going to work against a good team. Against, you know, the Cowboys were a good team, and it was our shot. And that's what I remember was the determination in everybody's eye, the grimness of, like, this is it. This is our Waterloo. And that was, and it turned out we won the game.
What other people remember is how cold it was that day and how loud it was that day. You recall those two things?
I recall the one time when we sealed the game at the end of the year. Before the game, I don't feel anything because you're concentrating on the game. But Leroy Harris, who really, Wilbert had the great touchdown run, but Leroy in the second half, who was always in Dick's doghouse. Dick, he had some hard runs in that second half that picked up first down. And Leroy scores a touchdown, and the place went wild. That's when it hit me. I go, this place is loud. This place is loud. This is loud. And that was like sealing the victory. You could almost feel it. I mean, it almost lifted you off the ground. When Leroy scored that touchdown that put us up, I think that gave us the, you know, the margin would be a two-score game. I forget the exact details. But I remember Leroy, who I think was the unsung hero in that game. In the second half of that game, he picked up some really tough yardage running between the tackles.
Yeah, he did. He played great. It's probably his high water mark as an Eagle. And, of course, Wilbert rushed for almost 200 himself when there were a lot of questions during the week leading up to the game as to whether he was even going to be able to play because he was so banged up by the end of the year. But it all came together. It all came together that day and in a game that the people in Philadelphia still talk about to this day. I have to ask you, 2 weeks later you go down to New Orleans and you play the Raiders and they win going away. And you look back on that. I mean, that was your one shot at a Super Bowl. And I know Jaworski says that hardly a day goes by that he still doesn't think about it. And it still bothers him to this day that he knows he's never going to get another chance to go back there and win that game. In your mind now, with the benefit of hindsight, what do you think really happened, Stan? Why did that team sort of come out and play the way they played that game against the Raiders? Because it was certainly atypical the way you had played all season.
Okay, let me just say the game plan, everything was all right. I don't criticize that. People said we worked too hard before the week. We did that. It was Dick's way of doing it. We went in and played, and we were a second half team. If you remember that year. It was Sid Gilman and Dick Vermeil making adjustments with Ron that we actually really were a second-half team. If you look at our stats, it was mostly second half. We get out there, and we're, I think, trailing by 3 or 7, right, at the first half.
Right.
Maybe you remember, right? Maybe 10. But we get out there, and we get the ball, and we're driving down the field. Well, first of all, remember, at the end of the first half, right, we had a touchdown call back by Rodney Parker. Somebody was moving a – one of the receivers was moving and got an illegal motion penalty, right? We had a touchdown call back, so that makes it 10-7, I think the score was, right?
And Franklin had a field goal block, right?
Then we go back in the second half, right? And our ball, we're kicking off, and they throw a screen pass to Kenny King, I think his name was, right? Who I think goes 80 yards with a screen pass, And that was the play that killed us. That was the play that hurt us, because that they went up, I think, 17. Now we got to come back and we got to pass the ball. If that interception doesn't happen or that touchdown is not called back, I think we go into our Eagles mode and we win the game. But right there, it changed up our whole game plan. And the adjustment was we had to go into them and we had to play into their pass. We had to pass more than we wanted to.
Stan Walters is our guest on Tell Us Your Story. I want to get into your second career because you retire in 1983. Had you always thought of doing media? You were so fun on the radio. Is it something that you had aspired to while you were playing?
It was something I grew up listening to John Sterling in New York City, sports talk. And I always thought it would be great to do a sports talk. I love talking sports. So that was something I did there. And then Billy Werndell, which you guys know, I told him one time, I'd love to have a show. Next thing I know, he's got me on WFIL doing a Friday night show, which we talked to. It was called On the Line with Stan Walters. So I did that. And having that broadcast experience, because I did it because I love talking sports, then all of a sudden the opportunity came. WIP approached me after my last game and said, would you like to do Eagles radio? I said, yeah, I'll try it. I'll do it. And then once again, it was an opportunity. Not that I actually love doing broadcast. I love talking sports. And so I could do it and work with Murrow for 14 years.
You know, talking about your playing career, I always found you to be, covering the team, I always just found you to be a fascinating guy to talk to. I mean, your perspective on life was so different. I mean, your interests were so different than a typical player. I mean, you're a guy that used to go to Broadway plays and talk about them endlessly. You read books. I mean, you were really a different sort of cat in that locker room for sure. And I remember one conversation that we had where you talked. I asked you about North Dallas 40, and I asked you about the book and then the movie that had come out. And you said, "Yeah, I got the book. I read one chapter, and I put it away. I didn't want to read any more than that because to me it was a distorted view of pro football as I knew it." Do you remember that and why you kind of felt that way?
Well, yes, because first of all, I just felt that there were guys who played the game because they loved it. I think of Louis Giamatti, John Bunting, guys who played the game because they loved football. They loved the essence of the game. I didn't love the essence of the game. It was strictly a job for me, and it was a job that I could do well, and I really enjoyed my job. I loved my job, but it was a job. It wasn't this passionate thing. It was something there, and I think that was why I just considered it a job, and when I went home, I had another life to live. I wasn't living, breathing, eating soup, football. To me, it was you go in, you do your work. If you do your job, you stay. If you don't do your job, you're going to get fired. So I think, and then I was very fortunate to grow up in New York, the New York area, with my parents, and they had a very for the best that they could do, they said keep your horizons broad. They broad horizons. My mother used to drag us to the Wednesday matinees in New York to the plays, and my father was a reader of books, and that was just I just continued my life. I went and did my work at the job, and I didn't think it was anything special to do it, except I got paid well. And I liked the work I did, and then I just would go on with life.
That's great. That's a great answer. I love that. Speaking of being a deep thinker, or this all makes you sound like a deep thinker, and Ray suggests that you are. I talked to Merrill the other day, and Merrill talked about how much fun it was working with you. And one of the things he said is Stan always had these theories. Make sure to ask him about the Jules Yakupovich radar defense. I don't know that I want you to describe that, but it does indicate that you were a guy who kind of took a deep look at what was out there when you were both playing and when you're broadcasting.
You know, the other day, it's funny you mentioned that, just the other day, I forget what game I was watching, but none of the defensive linemen were in the stands, and I thought of Jules Yakupovich. I thought of Jules Yakupovich because he had what he developed in high school, the radar defense, and that nobody was in a defensive lineman stance. Mm-hmm. And you didn't know who was going to be blitzing. I forget where I learned that or heard about that, but it was when I was in Syracuse because he was in the Buffalo, Lackawanna, upstate New York area, right?
Yeah.
And Jaworski, I said, hey, Jaworski. I go, did you ever play against Jules Yakupovich? He goes, whoa, who's that? How do you know that? I go, I know about the radar defense. I forget where I picked that up or where I learned it, but Jules Yakupovich and the radar defense, it was something that sticks in your mind.
Yeah.
And And just the other day, it was on TV, and they go, nobody's in the defensive line stance. I go, somewhere Jules Jakubowicz is smiling.
Well, you and Merrill had such a great chemistry. It just seemed very easy. You guys sounded like friends. Merrill suggested that you were. But what are your thoughts on that? You guys did 14 years on the chemistry you had between you.
Well, I really think it was Merrill grew up in Philadelphia. He loved the Philadelphia Eagles, and Merrill is a fan of the Eagles and the play-by-play broadcaster. I, on the other hand, was a former player, and I try to be objective. And I think what would happen is Merrill would say, hey, that was a real good play, and I would say, yes, it was this. And he said, that was a good, no, Merrill, don't get excited. That wasn't that good of a play, you know. In other words, I would try to bring the objectiveness to it and get his a little bit of his being an Eagle fan we grew up with and loved the job he was doing. And I think that was where we played off. And to tell you the truth, we never got mad at each other. I mean, it was if I corrected him or he corrected me about something we had factually wrong, we didn't hold it. It's just the way the broadcast went. I think we were both secure in our jobs. And once again, I'm doing a job that not because I love broadcast. I just love talking sports and going on the radio and watching the Eagles games. The fact was they offered me talk show jobs, and I didn't want that because I had talked baseball and basketball. I didn't know that much about them. But doing the radio was a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, I mean, and you were great. And you were a great team. And as Glenn said, 14 years is a long time, and it was terrific the whole time. But in terms of when you say you were objective, and you were most of the time, but Stan, I got to tell you, you weren't objective when the Eagles played the Cowboys. Okay, I mean that it was. I could tell that there was that those are the two games a year when your objectivity you checked it at the door. I mean, there was no anybody listening to those games knew exactly how you felt about the Dallas Cowboys.
Sometimes you lose your objectivity when that became passionate only because of the Cowboys, Landry, Tex Schramm, the whole group of guys you got, and I think I know where you're going about the Tex Schramm listening on the radio to my broadcast.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, we're in the game, and it was very interesting that the first four or five calls go against the Eagles, and Tex Schramm for years was the head of the competition committee, and a lot of people felt that the Cowboys, the guys on the competition committee, had an advantage over the rest of the teams because they controlled the referees. I mean, right? I remember one time there was a guy named Red. I forget his last name. He was the defensive. He was the head referee. We're playing the Miami Dolphins. The Shula was on the competition committee, and we're running off the field at halftime, and they called a pass interference penalty. Red Cashin, and Shula goes, Red. He goes, I'll teach you what pass interference is. I go, whoa, I guess these competition committee guys do have some power. You know what I mean? So we're playing, and the Eagles get four penalties against them, right? And I come on the air. I go, Tex Schramm's got the referees in his pocket. The next thing I look over, Tex Schramm's got his pockets empty. So I show me his pockets are empty. He was supposed to be our halftime guest. He canceled our halftime guest. They got a notice that we'll never be on the Eagles mailing, the Cowboys mailing list again. And that was it. But that was just emotion overcoming that. But the funny part was we go in to do Buddy Ryan's show the next day. He goes, well, after Landry and the Schramm got the Cowboys start calling plays, he goes, then we were able to go on and win the game. But we won that game. The Eagles won that game. It's funny, I say we. I would have said the Eagles, but maybe you're right, Ray. The Cowboys game, all of a sudden I lost my objectivity watching the game.
That's okay. Nobody holds it against you.
Yeah,
no,
we loved you for it. Stan, we got about 5 minutes to go. I want to do a little quick word association. If I say the name of a guy, you give me a 15-second review.
Okay, I'll try.
Ron Jaworski.
Good quarterback. Good man, good teammate, and funny guy during stretching before practice.
Buddy Ryan.
Jekyll and Hyde. The nicest man away from a microphone. Put him in front of a microphone, and I didn't want to know him.
Dick Vermeil.
The second most influential man in my life. My father taught me the right and wrongs and gave me an example. Dick Vermeil, I got a chance to coach basketball in England when I was living there, and I used the Dick Vermeil playbook of inspiring the players, and we went from a 2-6 record to 16-0 the next year.
Wow. Randall Cunningham.
Boy, Randall, what Starship 12 is the nickname I gave. You just didn't know where Randall was going to be coming into a game. You just hope he was somewhere in the universe, and then the Eagles would have a chance to win.
I'll give one more and see if Ray wants to throw any in. Norman Brayman,
strictly business. One time he said to me, Dennis Harrison was holding out. He said, looked at me and he said, what would Dennis Harrison be doing if he wasn't playing football? And I looked at Norman and I said, what would Frank Sinatra be doing if he couldn't sing?
Good answer.
Yeah. Right? That's the man's talent.
Yeah.
Yep.
I was going to ask you, Stan, about a moment that you and I both talked about, and it was when Dick Vermeil won his Super Bowl, when he won it with the St. Louis Rams. And on television, when he's on the podium and they present him with the Lombardi Trophy, at that moment being televised all over the place with all the confetti falling and all that stuff, the thing that Dick says is he holds the trophy up and he says, I hope that my guys from the 1980 Eagles team understand that I'm thinking about them right now and understand that they're part of this too. And I know you said you were watching at that time and you got a lump in your throat that the relationship that he had with you guys was still so strong that even in that moment when he won the Super Bowl, he was thinking about the team that got there and didn't win it. That was very, for you guys, that had to be a very powerful moment.
I was watching that game in a pub in England that had permission to stay open, and we were living in England at the time, and I was watching the game. I was happy for him, and to tell you the truth, that brought a tear to my eye. And I go, well, we didn't win it, but we gave it our best. And I was so happy for him. I was happy for him to get that championship. He got his Moby Dick, you know what I mean? He got his whale. And I wasn't there, but maybe we were along the way, got the boat started.
So, Stan Walters, as we said, you did 14 years as Eagles color guy alongside Merrill. And you just mentioned England. And when you left that, I don't know if it was right away, but you eventually moved to England with your wife, who was a very high-powered executive. I remember one time I had you on, and you described yourself as a kept man.
Yeah. Okay. I like to think of, yes, I got very fortunate. Marrying my wife is the best thing that ever happened to me. When I got those raises, she was smart enough to realize we didn't know what we were doing with our money. And she said, we were making good money. And she said, she went and found a guy by the name of Frank McCullough, who was recommended to us by my cousin. And she went with him. And Frank said, listen, no 28-year-old kid is making $35,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year. He goes, you live on Kathy's salary and you bank your own. And at that time, that was, we were taking a lifestyle cut because we were living on a $30,000 a year salary when I'm making around $200,000. But as it turned out, it paid off in the end because we banked my salary for the last 12 years of my career.
And then you came back here, and now people are probably wondering where you're living these days, and you're down in Atlanta. And Kathy is still working, and you're playing golf. Sounds like a pretty good life to me.
Well, in my time, football gave us a great start in life. I was able to afford she went to Wharton School. We paid for that. She graduated. She ran it. She retired now. And then she took on another job. She's now the chairman of the Board of Trustees of Syracuse University. So she's running up there all the time with all the problems around COVID and everything. She's running there. So I'm still kept man here tending the home fires here and taking care of my two children who are now 30 years old. So I'm just sitting around. I'm sitting in my back garden now doing this show saying, yeah, it's been pretty good life. I got lucky. You're talking to a lucky man.
Good for you. Well, Stan Walters, everybody in Philadelphia was lucky to watch your career as a player and to listen to you all those years with Merrill as a broadcaster. It has been our pleasure to host you this hour. Tell Us Your Story is sponsored by Meridian Bank, one of the area's best business banks. Learn why at meridianbanker.com/WIP. Stan Walters, thank you so much for your time. It is always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Glenn, Ray.
There you go. That was entirely fun. That was 45 minutes of fun.
Sure was. Sure was. It reminds me of when I covered the guy. I was around him his whole career with the Eagles, and just a delight. And I think anybody that was listening to the last 45 minutes could tell. I mean, what a bright guy he is, with a guy with a multitude of interests, and a guy with a good heart. And a guy who went from being a purebred New Yorker to being a guy who truly loved and got Philadelphia. and really one of the best offensive linemen this team's ever had, a member of the Eagles Hall of Fame, and a big, big part of that team that went to the first Super Bowl.
Yeah, and such an entertaining character as a broadcaster. So there was one thing I want to just follow up with you on this. By the way, if you want to get in real quick, we're here for another, whatever, 10 minutes or so, 215-592-9494. I was really struck by him saying several times, I didn't love playing football.
Right.
I did it because it was my job.
It was a job.
I didn't love the violent part of it. I wasn't Mr. Rah-Rah. I played football. You don't hear that often from, well, at least I don't hear that often from players. Do you, or even in retirement?
Very rare. Very rare. And that's exactly the way he was. That's one of the things that made him interesting to me, was it was a job, you know. And he always used to, that's why I asked him the question about North Dallas 40, because anybody that's read the book or seen the movie knows that there's a part of that movie, and it was a good movie, but it really does make you look like you have to be some kind of a sociopath to play the game. And Stanley was not. I mean, Stanley was a guy going to the office every day. It just so happened that he was putting on shoulder pads and playing football. But this idea of we got to go out, we got to kill him, that was just, I mean, he used to laugh at that kind of stuff. I mean, he was a complete professional. It was his job. It was his profession. He was good at it. He made a good living. But that was where it stopped. But don't discount what a warrior he was. I mean, what he did in that championship game, taking the pain-killing shot in his back to go out and play on that bitter cold day and line up against Harvey Martin that day. Mm-hmm. I mean, he says it was just a job, but on the day when you needed him, Stan Walters was always there.
Yeah, and I also love the part where early in Vermeil's tenure with the Eagles, where I guess Stan had been here for 2 or 3 years, Vermeil says, anybody who doesn't want to play or come and see me. Which I always imagine is just kind of imagine as rhetorical.
Right.
They don't expect anybody to come in.
And Stan went?
Stan came. Yeah, you could trade me. It's all right.
Oh, he was very unhappy that training camp because it was so brutal. I mean, it really was. And that was part of what – that was by design. I mean, Dick made it brutal to drive out the guys who didn't have the commitment that he was looking for. And Stan, after having played for Paul Brown, just said, this isn't what I signed up for. And –
yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I can't imagine Paul Brown being that easygoing.
No, he was.
Really?
He was. He was
Paul
Brown. Yeah, but he was not.
He invented football.
Yeah, but he didn't. He was more of a tactician, and he wasn't a slave driver. And the players all said that he was cheap. He was cheap, and he was demanding, and he set high standards. But he wasn't a guy that was. He didn't brutalize his players. That first summer at Widener, Dick Vermeil brutalized those players.
Yeah, well, that's legendary.
But Stan says to this day that he made him a better player. That he was a good player up to that point, but Dick pushed him into being a Pro Bowl level player.
Yeah, I get that. So next week at this very time, we are going to be honored to host Jim Gardner. And Ray, I'm going to flatter you here because when Jim announced earlier this week that he's planning to lighten his load in 2022 and then retire at the end of the year. It was Tim Kelly, who does work at WIP, posted a tweet that said, there are only two beloved figures, I don't have it exactly right, in Philadelphia media. Say it again. Say it out loud, Moshe.
I believe it was two universally beloved sports figures.
Well, Jim's not a sports figure. I think he said figures.
Or just figures.
In Philadelphia media, Jim Gardner and Ray Dinger.
Oh, wow.
So that's pretty good company.
Yeah, well, that's I appreciate that. That's awfully nice of Tommy.
And I expanded the list. So here's what I wrote. I know we only have 2 minutes. Maybe we'll do this a little bit more tomorrow. I said, who are the people in local media that pretty much everyone likes?
Mm-hmm.
Here's my list. Jim Gardner, Ray Dinger, Cecily Tynan, Merrill, Yuki Washington. By the way, most of these people have been guests on Tell Us Your Story. Keith Jones,
yep,
Fransky in L.A., Mike Quick.
That's a good list.
Yeah, and anybody I'm leaving out, and somebody gave me one that I think should be there, Derek Gunn. Nobody dislikes Derek Gunn.
No, not at all. Not at all. That's a good list. I'm flattered to be on it.
Yeah, well, so next week, Jim Gardner, I'm really looking forward to that. And the point of it is, somebody who's been doing it, he's been on the air here for more than 40 years.
Yep.
Never embarrassed himself.
Nope.
Never did silliness.
No.
Never had a scandal.
No.
Never did anything to betray the trust of his audience.
No.
And that's a rare and wonderful thing.
For generations. A guy that all the people, and Lord knows the ratings tell you, all the people go to at the news. And he's a guy that you trust. And he's earned it. This is not an easy town. This is not an easy town to win their trust. But he did it, and he sustained it for generations. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I'm really looking forward to that. Anyway, you and I will be back tomorrow at 10 o'clock as we will really deep dive into the Eagles at the Denver Broncos.
Right.
Let's make John in Philadelphia the winner of the Caller of the Day. We disagreed with what John had to say, but it was the first time he ever called WIP.
Yeah.
A little bit nervous about it, and I want to reward him for doing that. He wins the $50 gift certificate to Scheib Sports. Congratulations to him.
Good for John.
Yeah, good for him. Dave Breitmeyer produced here, and back in the studio was Moshe Kravitz.
Mm-hmm.
Ray, before we go, you got a book signing?
Yes, I'm on my way right now. I've got a book signing coming up starting at 3 o'clock. I may even be there a little earlier than that, but it's at the Barnes & Noble by the Moorestown Mall.
That's a good place. We've done prior book signings there.
Yes, we have. And I did one actually there shortly after the book came out back in the spring, and it was great. And they asked me to come back again. So I'm on my way there right now. So Barnes & Noble off the Moorestown Mall. I will be there this afternoon in about an hour or so for signing copies of Finished Business.
Very nice.
Drop in and say hello.
All right. So go see Ray, and we will see you tomorrow morning. Stay tuned. Go Birds Radio is up after this.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.